You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa. Nau mai haere mai ki te wai mo tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Evie. Coming up on the show, I speak to National Chair of the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa, John Minto, about the 24 pro-Palestinian protests that occurred across the country over the weekend. I also speak to PhD candidate in Environmental Sciences at the University of Auckland, Nargis Talib, about experts calling for stricter standards surrounding compostable products. Evie, what do you have for us today?
So for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Kaur, we talk about the proposed repeal of Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act. I also spoke to the University of Auckland's Emira Kete on her concerns surrounding this repeal and a Ngāpuhihi koi happening in opposition today. And finally, I talked to the University of Auckland's Kendra Cox about the government's youth offender boot camps that finally kicked off last week and her concerns on how this will affect rangatahi Māori and their mental health.
Hey, aho o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātui mai, text in 5395 or wire mai rānei. Give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Ko e wareware e a hei ana koto te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero e ano hei pakihere rokiroki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Poho me haere ki 95BFM irekati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Earlier this year, legislation was introduced to repeal Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act. Section 7AA emphasises the importance of Māori youth being placed with families that represent their whakapapa, as well as honouring principles of titiriti or waitangi. The ACT Party and Minister for Children Karen Chaw says this section is putting children in danger, removing them from stable families to place them instead with whānau that align with their whakapapa and iwi. Oranga Tamariki, however, say there is no empirical evidence to support these claims, causing widespread backlash with many believing the move is simply pushing the ACT Party's ideologies. Today, Ngāpuhi, Aotearoa's largest iwi, Arono Hikoi, to Parliament in opposition to the repeal, saying it will disadvantage Māori rangatahi who make up the majority of those in state care. For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to the ACT Party's Simon Kaur about the intentions of the repeal and the party's feelings around the backlash. Advice offered to the Minister of Children by Oranga Tamariki officials themselves, just to quote them, is that there is no empirical evidence to support the notion that Section 7AA has driven practical decisions that have led to changing care arrangements. Although they have heard a small amount of anecdotal concerns from caregivers around the issue, they've concluded that there's no evidence to link those to Section 7AA. So why is it that the Minister continues to move forward despite the direct advice from Oranga Tamariki?
Well, I haven't read that advice, but what we do know is that Oranga Tamariki staff were involved in uplifting a child, Mary, whose parents were told that they could not care for her because and that their home environment was inappropriate because they could not demonstrate that they had Maori ancestry. And that child was removed, which would have been incredibly traumatic for that child. And it's that story, plus a number of others, that the Minister has become aware of in opposition, and that's informed her judgment. But it just seems outrageous that young, vulnerable children would be uplifted from safe, loving families and put into the care of whānau they don't know in a faraway place at an age they can't comprehend what's going on. I mean, it's just quite heartbreaking. So while Orang and Tamariki have looked deep into their own statistics to try to justify why this shouldn't happen, actually we know it has happened because there have been court cases about it and Orang and Tamariki have lost.
Within the Orang and Tamariki Act, the consideration of children's whakapapa in decision making is mentioned repeated times, not just in section 7AA. But these other sections that it's mentioned in aren't on the list of repeal. It's been said that the intention of repealing 7AA is removing the priority of whakapapa in decision making so children don't get uplifted. But if it's in there multiple times, what is the real intention if it's still going to remain in the Oranga Tamariki Act?
Well, I think it's important that children's family linkages and family is considered when thinking about the family they're being taken from, if that's necessary to protect their safety, and the family they might be placed with. You want to make sure that family they're going to be placed with is safe. Particularly one place to start is with existing family ties. But for many children, actually, it's family that's the problem. So thinking about 7AA, the problem with 7AA is it requires decision makers to take account of the Treaty of Waitangi. And we know how that's worked with Pharmac, and we've got rid of it because it doesn't make any sense. The same with Health New Zealand tool that established a discriminatory waitlist, apparently based on the government's obligations to a group of people under the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, that absolutely ignores the fundamental needs of humans and the dignity of each individual. And the purpose of Karen Chaw's reforms to the Orang and Tamariki Act is to, instead of focusing on characteristics like who your ancestors were, which is poor and lazy and neglects the best interests of vulnerable children, Karen's focus is actually about the need for children's safety. And any suggestion that their safety and well-being shouldn't come first is frankly ludicrous.
Yeah, I understand that, but what I'm saying is that these other sections, Section 4, Section 5, Section 13, for example, they all say the same thing about whakapapa, which is pretty much what 7AA is talking about, minus tatiriti, as you mentioned. But how does that one clause about tatiriti change what we're talking about?
Well, because that one clause seems to have been used to justify all kind of policy approaches which are just not backed up by evidence. So, you know, that's like with Health New Zealand, their tool that based the waiting list prioritisation on race rather than whether you were in a remote community or had any other characteristics that might mean that you deserved attention or needed attention first. Same with Pharmac. It's just completely unnecessary to have a Treaty of Waitangi focus when delivering modern medicines. Those things are unnecessary. It's also unnecessary, the Orang and Tamariki Act. And I think you make a good point, and I agree with you. Throughout the Act, it says we need to look at who the children's family are because it may well be that they're the most appropriate group or the most appropriate place to put a child who is unsafe. But again, you know, the reason these children are in unsafe situations is because their family home is unsafe. So these are all matters that decision makers, you know, who are caring for children need to take very seriously. And that's what Karen Chaw's focused on. But it's certainly not having a government department view their role in protecting vulnerable children through the treaty lens. That is not appropriate. And that's why we're focusing on taking out those causes from legislation where we can find them.
So we talk about the idea of evidence here. So the Children's Minister has been repeatedly grilled in interviews to disclose some empirical evidence behind her decision making, something she said she would do after submissions were made on the bill. I know you mentioned one case before, but is there currently any further evidence to offer?
Well, Karen Chaw is the Minister for Children, and she's basing her policy approach on evidence that she has seen, and I trust her to do her job. But you raised the point about Karen being grilled before. Karen hasn't just been grilled. She's been abused and bullied by other MPs in Parliament.
I do understand that, and I appreciate what you're saying, but if we could circle back to the question, the original question, I'm just wondering if you have any evidence on hand to offer, or are you saying that only the Minister of Children has access to that evidence at the moment?
Well, my portfolio is a resource management reform and infrastructure funding and financing, so no, I don't have that evidence before me, and I wouldn't expect to see it unless I was involved in working on the policy. But I do trust Karen Chua. She grew up in state care. She knows what it's like to grow up feeling unsafe and to be a victim of the system. If there's anyone I trust to know what children need who are in that situation, it's Karen Chua. And I'm absolutely positive that she's basing the policy decisions that she's taking that will lead to legislative change on sound information.
Moving on, so today Ngā Puhi, the largest iwi in Aotearoa, are on a hikoi to Parliament in opposition of this repeal, among other things. They have major concerns about the well-being and treatment of tamariki in state care, and they're calling for iwi-based solutions. Is this something the government's considered, or if not, why haven't they?
Of course, I understand Orangata Tamariki contracts many different social service providers, including iwi service providers. I understand from Karen that she's visited with many of these organisations and iwi groups around the country to find out more about what they do and to offer her support for the good work they do. So I'm not quite sure why this needs a hikoi, because it's already happening. And, of course, Karen has made herself available to meet with these with all kinds of groups, including iwi-led organisations who deliver these.
Is this a huge amount of concern and backlash and discourse since the announcement of the repeal not a cause for concern?
Well, it's not really a huge amount of backlash. It's a backlash from a very, what you might say is very agitated, but rather small group of people. The backlash has had a lot of lash in it. It's been pretty nasty. There's been a lot of personal attacks that Karen's had to endure that other MPs have not had to deal with. And it's primarily focused on the fact that she is Māori and she doesn't appear to be following what some people who claim to speak for Māori believe that she should do. And so one of the challenges for the ACT Party and for being a minister in the ACT Party is that you have to go back and ask yourself, what are we here for? Is it to make individuals' lives better? What can the government do? What should the government stop doing? And I would say in Karen's case, she's absolutely focused on the individual dignity and rights of each child to be safe and to have a safe family home. And, you know, whether there are some people who disagree with her about policy, well, we understand that. We haven't heard any coherent or cogent policy arguments against what Karen is trying to do. But what we have seen is a whole lot of personal attacks on her character, primarily based on the fact that she's Māori. It's pretty disgusting. And, you know, we're asking, you know, in Parliament and outside of Parliament is let's have a debate about policy, about ideas that you think work and why they work better. But for goodness sakes, can we please stop attacking Karen the person?
That was the ACT Party's Simon Kaur on the proposed repeal of Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act.
That was Simon Kaur from the ACT Party.
The Wire.
On Friday, I also talked to a criminology lecturer at the University of Auckland, Eme Rakete, who is Ngā Puhi, about her concerns surrounding the repeal of Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act. We also talked about the Ngā Puhi hikoi taking place today in opposition to the Act and what they believe the government should be doing next. Backlash surrounding the proposed repeal of Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act has been ongoing for quite some time now. Now, in the coming week, Ngā Puhi have two hikoi planned in opposition to this. Have these been in the works for a while, or has something specific triggered this now?
The hikoi that Ngā Puhi are making are in response to a number of policies that this government has been pursuing that have been to the detriment of Māori. We've seen over the course of this administration an overall hostility towards Māori and towards the Te Tiriti partnership that was established at the foundation of this country. But it's really the attacks on Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act, led by the ACT Party and by Minister for Children Karen Chua, that have brought this conflict to fruition with these hikoi.
What are your main concerns for Māori tamariki around the repeal of 7AA?
So Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act clarifies that the government has a responsibility to partner with iwi Māori and with Māori social organisations to ensure that tamariki Māori stay within their whānau, hapū and iwi when they enter into the child protection system. Now, the Oranga Tamariki Act is completely unambiguous that at all times the state's highest responsibility is the well-being of children, and nothing in the Act, not even Section 7AA, overrides that ultimate responsibility. Now, the Minister for Children has systematically mystified this in order to present her attack on Section 7AA as being in the interests of children. But Section 7AA could never have been used to put children in situations where they would have been in danger anyway. So there's no safekeeping or safeguarding responsibility argument that can be made in favour of the repeal of Section 7AA. It is instead a purely ideological attack on Māori, on the political power of Māori organisations, on the mana of Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and on Māori social organisations. Moana Irueta, Dr. Moana Irueta, as the head of Ngāpuhi Iwi Social Services, has put in years building a relationship with Oranga Tamariki to try to keep Ngāpuhi children and Māori children as a whole out of state care and inside of their whānau, their hapū and their iwi, so that they remain connected to mana Māori. The repeal of Section 7AA is a direct attack on the work that she's been doing, on the work that Māori across the country have been doing, and so a backlash like this has been completely inevitable as soon as the government began pursuing this policy.
So just to clarify, you're saying that the Minister for Children is basically spreading information that's factually incorrect to what is actually in Section 7AA?
Whenever the government looks to change the law, the ministry does a policy advice document, basically saying what could happen if we did go ahead with this change. And by Oranga Tamariki's own analysis, Section 7AA never led to any Māori children coming to harm, could never have led to any Māori children coming to harm, and there is no evidence whatsoever that Section 7AA was ever used to put Māori children into situations which are unsafe. The minister has relied on insinuation, and she's relied upon anecdote, but nobody at any point has ever presented any kind of evidence-based argument for the repeal of Section 7AA. It is a purely ideological attack upon Māori, led by the ACT Party and facilitated by this government.
The Minister of Children has made it quite clear that she doesn't have any plans to move backwards on the repeal. It's something she definitely wants to go forward with. So what is Ngāpuhi hoping to achieve with the hikoi and other protest?
This is an assertion of sovereignty on the part of Ngāpuhi. We never ceded, I'm from Ngāpuhi, we never ceded sovereignty to the New Zealand government, and the Paparahi o Te Raki report from the Waitangi Tribunal has been very clear that we always retained our national sovereignty. But Māori, Ngāpuhi children make up a plurality of Māori children in state care. We have seen over decades that the state care system systemically enabled the rape, torture and abuse of young people and children in this country, a majority of whom were Māori. This Minister for Children has been handed, in the last week, a report showing that 200,000 children and young people were raped, tortured or abused in the state care system. And the attack, this attack on Section 7AA, is likely to cause more tamariki and rangatahi Māori to be taken into state care, where we have very well-founded fears that they will face violence of the exact same kind that was facilitated for decades by Karen Chow's predecessors. So there are very real concerns on the part of Māori that this attack on Section 7AA will result in serious harm being caused to Māori children. And it is that fear and that principle to protect and defend Māori children that's motivating Ngāpuhi to go ahead with this hikoi.
Yeah, I did want to touch on the Royal Commission of Inquiry into Abuse in State Care, which is what you're referencing, and just to ask if concerns have increased following the results of that, which it sounds like they have. And just to clarify, are you worried that this change could possibly trigger a repeat of history?
So we had for decades in this country a child protection system which used borstals, child boot camps, child prison camps, which facilitated serious physical and sexual abuse of children in the history of this country. 200,000 people at least were victimised in this way. And at the same time as this government is attacking its responsibilities to Māori and attacking the rights of Māori to have not just to say, but to have control over the child protection system. It is also pushing ahead with a return to something like the Borstal system, a return to boot camps, a return to prison camps for children and young people. So yes, there are very, very real fears that the government is simultaneously making the child protection system much less transparent and also returning to a form of youth justice, which we know in the past was used to facilitate physical and sexual violence against children and young people.
So on top of the opposition to the repeal of 7AA, Ngāpuhi walked out of a meeting with the Prime Minister today in protest of other coalition policies. What are some other concerns surrounding recent policies from the government?
Well, the Treaty Principles Bill, which has been much discussed, is another form that this government's hostile orientation towards Māori and towards Te Tiriti has taken. But this is a very predictable response. Like, this is how people respond when their rights and their political power are infringed upon. So actions like this will inevitably happen and will probably continue to happen in the future.
That was the University of Auckland's Eme Rākete on the Ngāpuhi opposition to the proposed repeal of Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act. Text us in on 5395. Any of your thoughts on these pieces? We'll be right back. Keep it on the B.
Get some floss because you're going to be picking popcorn out of your teeth all August.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival is back for 2024, August 7 to 18.
Tickets are on sale now, so message the group chat, get online and get booking before it starts selling out.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, August 7 to 18. For schedule and tickets, go to nziff.co.nz.
Wow, music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them in a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The August playlist features tracks from Elliot and Vincent, Marlon Streaming, TG Shand, Kim Deal, Goat and many more. Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Oh, Freedom to be the president of the United States. Freedom to grow up and own your own business. Freedom to do something positive for the community. Freedom for every man, woman, boy, and girl. Freedom to do what you want when you want to do it. Freedom to speak your mind and voice your opinion. Freedom to stand up for something you believe in. Freedom to overcome the obstacles that stand in your way. Freedom to pursue the right to be free. The message is freedom. Peace.
you know, alcohol is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay. It's BFM.
The Wire.
Over the weekend, 24 pro-Palestinian protests occurred across Aotearoa, from Opononi in the far north to Invercargill. This comes a week after the government released a joint statement with Australia and Canada regarding Israel's war in Gaza, which further follows a top UN court saying that Israel is illegally occupying Palestinian territory. I spoke to Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa National Chair, John Minto, about the protests and the importance of continuing to show up to protest actions. Over the past weekend, Aotearoa saw 24 different pro-Palestinian protests occur across the country, from Opononi in the far north to Invercargill. What has the turnout been like for these protests?
Well, the turnout has been, you know, for the last few months, has been very steady. It's not as much as it was in the early days of the war in Gaza, but it's amazing to me that people are still coming out in very large numbers. And I think we're making a special effort to increase numbers for next weekend, and I think we'll see a big surge then. But yeah, I'm really proud of the fact New Zealanders have come out week after week for the past 10 months while this genocide's been going on. It's something for us to be proud of.
As you briefly touched on, we have seen extensive protests steadily occurring throughout Aotearoa since October 7. Has the government been listening and paying attention to these protests?
Yeah, the government's been paying attention, but at the same time, it wants to go along with what the US and Israel want. So we haven't seen any marked change in government policy, but they're certainly watching, and I think they realise that they must respond much more forcefully because of particularly the International Court of Justice ruling, which came out 2 weeks ago, which really puts the acid on the countries that are supporting the US and Israel.
And last week, the government released a joint statement regarding Israel's war in Gaza. What does the statement highlight regarding the government's stance on Palestine?
Well, what the statement highlights is that the government is full of rhetoric, but nothing in terms of effective pressure on Israel to stop its war on the Palestinian people. So the government has condemned every instance of Palestinian resistance, every instance of countries trying to hold Israel to account, but it has never condemned any action which Israel's taken, despite the fact that we've had over 40,000 people killed in Gaza. 40,000 people, most of them women and children, most of them civilians, killed in this Israeli onslaught against the Palestinian people of Gaza. So the people of the world can see it for what it is, but Western governments and the Western media at large are downplaying Israel's culpability for what's happening, and are in fact providing cover, political cover for Israel, in a most appalling manner, and New Zealand is an active part of that.
What sort of response would you like to see to coming out of the government?
Well, the government should take its responsibilities under international law seriously. We are required under international law to prevent acts of genocide, and if we take that, you know, any reasonable reading of that responsibility under the Genocide Convention, then the government would join the South African case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. We would stop the export of components from New Zealand, which are going in to make the bombs, which are killing people in Gaza. There are numerous steps we would take to put real pressure on Israel over this, in the same way we have put real pressure on Russia over its invasion and occupation of Ukraine. Unfortunately, we've got double standards operating here, and a government which sees its relationship with the US as much more important than standing up for human rights and for justice for Palestinians in the Middle East.
And I just want to touch on some things you said earlier about the protests and how the attendance has slightly been decreasing. Why do you think this is, and what can we do to increase the attendance like we've seen in past protests?
Yeah, I think recently the attendance has been steady for a long time, but not so it's not dropping, but it's not as big as the protests were in the early days of the invasion. And I think it's simply a fact that the New Zealand media has been taking the lead from the US media and and the UK media, and so we're not seeing as much of the conflict as much of the war on our TV screens or in our newspapers. And so it goes out of people's sort of minds. But I think what's happening right now is so important for New Zealanders to be active out there and voicing their opposition to what's going on, continuing to do it. And people are doing that, and I think next weekend we've got a big push to increase those numbers so that we get, you know, we again build much more pressure on our government to act.
That was Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa National Chair John Minto about the protests and the importance of continuing to show up to protest actions.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Last week, the government finally launched their Youth Offender Military Academies, more commonly known as boot camps. Since their announcement, the idea of the camps has caused a lot of concern surrounding their effectiveness and treatment of youth. The first camp has taken in 10 youth, 9 of which are Māori. In Aotearoa's history, as well as globally, there's repeated evidence that a tough approach to boot camps hasn't been effective in lowering youth crime or rehabilitating the youth involved. On top of this, the release of the Royal Commission of Inquiry into Abuse in State Care last week has amplified concerns that these boot camps may contribute to a cycle of abuse, particularly for Māori youth. I spoke to lecturer in Counselling, Human Services and Social Work at the University of Auckland, Kendra Cox, about what these boot camps may look like and the potential impact they'll have on Māori youth. The pilot for Young Offender Military Academies, or boot camps, was launched last week. And there's no secret that the idea has been subject to a lot of backlash, even before they began. What are your main concerns surrounding these boot camps?
My main concerns surrounding the introduction of these boot camps, which opened last week, is not only the impact that it will have on the individual young people, the rangatahi there, 10 young people, 9 of whom are Māori, but also the kind of wider impacts and this real tough-on-crime approach that fails to even look at the kind of social and economic drivers of crime and harm. Firstly, on the individual side of things, you know, there's so much evidence out there, both from Aotearoa in the 80s and 90s and globally, you know, over the last sort of 40 years, that says that boot camps do not work to reduce crime. In fact, this kind of disciplinary style approach actually has the opposite impact, and it's more likely to be criminogenic, which means that it's likely to create and maintain the causes of crime. You know, young people who are around kind of other young people who are from backgrounds of struggle, deprivation, and who have likely come from backgrounds where they've witnessed or even been subjected to violence in their own communities and in their own whānau. It kind of creates this environment where these young people will be more likely to use violence and create harm in the future. In terms of impact on these individual young people's mental health, we've recently seen the reports from the Royal Commission of Inquiry into Abuse in State and Faith-Based Care, which shows that boot camps generally are very harmful, you know. These sorts of approaches, they don't kind of have aroha, they don't have support, and they don't have the trauma-informed kind of care that these young people really need.
The government has relabeled these boot camps as Young Offender Military Academies. It does sound quite hardcore. So how do you expect them to operate? They haven't released anything specifically, but do you have any idea what sort of things the young people inside these camps are going to be experiencing?
No. So the government hasn't really been particularly open about what this program will look like. What they have said is that it will be around 3 months of this sort of military-style academy, which really is a boot camp by another name, and then 9 months of transition into rehabilitation at home. Again, we're not really sure on what the specifics of this mean. However, what we do know is that Mark Mitchell, who's the Minister for Police, has said that up to 30 New Zealand Defence Force personnel will be involved in this, whereas last week Christopher Luxon said that there would be 2 social workers and some unnumbered amount of senior psychologists involved in this program, which really goes to show where the priorities lie here. This is definitely an intervention which is focused on discipline, and as much as the government recently has been saying it's not about punishment, that was certainly the rhetoric that the government was using prior to the election, and it tends to really depend on who the audience is. So it's very much about discipline and punitive responses and not about trauma-informed care. And nor is it about addressing, you know, the social and economic conditions that actually create and maintain crime and harmful behaviour.
Is that non-disclosure of the methods that they're going to be using a cause for concern at all?
Yes, certainly this flip-flopping from Minister for Children, Karen Chow, and our Prime Minister, and also from Minister of Police, Mark Mitchell as well. There's been a general flip-flopping between whether it's going to be tough on crime or whether it's going to be trauma-informed care. And so they're really playing, you know, they're trying to play to different bases. And I think a lot of this is really in reaction to the release of the reports into abuse and care a couple of weeks ago. When these reports were released, you know, there was a lot of course, media coverage surrounding this, as there should be. You know, we've seen that more than 200,000 young people, children and adults have been abused in care between 1950 and 2019. So it certainly should be a cause for concern. We know, as evidence from both Aotearoa and globally has shown, that boot camps, tend towards becoming abusive in one way or another. And on the other side of things, they also do nothing to actually reduce crime. So it's certainly a cause for concern.
Yeah, I did want to touch on that report, the Abuse and State Care report. There's a lot of concern that these boot camps are going to promote abuse, like outlined in the report. Do you think this is a possibility? Are there concerns that history may repeat itself in a way?
Yes, and well before the launch of these boot camps last week, you know, as soon as this came out on the national coalition governments, the coalition agreement that there would be a return to boot camps through this pilot, there has always been massive concern, you know, that they could create conditions of abuse within these boot camps, as we've seen in the recent reports into abuse and state care. And that's not only because of, you know, this disciplinary kind of punitive approach, which tends globally and here in Aotearoa to create conditions where abuse can happen and where abuse can be covered up. Not necessarily from kind of staff towards young people, it's also among young people as well. You know, this is being run out of a youth justice facility. We've already seen, you know, within the past few weeks, reports released by Mana Mokopuna, which was previously the Office of the Children's Commissioner, about systemic issues in our youth justice facilities, where staff broadly, you know, are undertrained, they're under-resourced, there's not enough senior oversight, and that they tend towards creating kind of conditions of abuse among young people and from staff towards young people as well.
And finally, there have been concerns as well how these boot camps are going to have an impact, particularly on the mental health of Māori youth. An OAIA report showed that nearly 80% of the cohort entering these camps have a confirmed or suspected mental health diagnosis. Do you think this is going to be dealt with well in these boot camps?
One thing that has really been missing, and I have been looking for it, one thing that has been missing, you know, from the kōrero around the introduction of these boot camps is any use of words aroha, any use of the word mana or whakapapa, you know, for these young people that are going into these boot camps. 9 out of these 10 young people in this pilot have Māori whakapapa, you know, and there's been no mention of tikanga kind of informed care. There's been no mention of aroha, restoration of mana, and kind of connection to whakapapa for these young people. And when we're thinking about Māori mental health, and again, 9 out of these 10 young people are Māori, they need to include these dimensions, which we have known and which this government has known, you know, since the work of Mason Jury and this sort of cohort of people since the 1980s that have always shown that we need a holistic approach to Māori mental health care and to health care more generally as well. And so when we have a program which has, you know, up to 30 New Zealand Defence Force personnel, a couple of social workers and maybe one or two senior psychologists, that is certainly a cause for concern.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
I would just add that this is really part of political point scoring, and it really reflects this government's kind of wider approach to being tough on crime. You know, not only do we have the introduction of this kind of boot camp project, but we also have the massive expansion of Waikerea Prison. We have $1.9 billion, you know, that's being added on top of our normal, our average, you know, yearly corrections budget as well. So this is really part of their approach that's focused on punishing people, whether it's adults or young people, and not addressing any of the actual kind of social and economic conditions that cause crime. Poverty, deprivation, social isolation, social dysfunction, and the drivers of family harm and child abuse and neglect. And if we actually want to stop young people from committing crime and, you know, committing harm in their communities, that is where we need to put the money. We need to go to these young people, to their whānau, to their communities, to their hapū and iwi, and ask them what they need and what can we do to fix this.
That was the University of Auckland's Kendra Cox on the government's youth offender boot camp's effect on Māori youth. Text us in on 5395, any of your thoughts on these pieces. We'll be right back. Keep it on the B.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Last year, the University of Auckland conducted a study into how compostable products affect soil health, which was commissioned by the Ministry of Environment. Three new reports have been published about the findings, which advocate for better regulations around these products. I spoke to PhD candidate in environmental sciences at the University of Auckland, Nargis Talib, about the findings of the study and what this means for soil quality. Last year, the Ministry of Environment commissioned researchers at the University of Auckland to look into how compostable products affect soil health. Could you explain some of the findings of these studies?
So we had a look at 10 different compostable products across the market, sort of based on, you know, how consumers are using it and what was of research interest. And we found that there's quite a lot of contaminants that are being added into these products. Things like heavy metals, PFAS, which is a carbon fluorinated polymer, which is quite stable in the environment, and also things like bisphenol and phthalates, which are in the current disrupting chemicals.
What are some ways that these compostable products could be better tailored to tackle the climate crisis?
Yeah, so the problem with these compostable products is if we do send them to the composting facilities, any sort of contaminants that are in these products will end up in the final compost, and thus when applied on land could have effects on soils and obviously outcrops and the foods that we eat off the land. So a major thing that we are wanting to showcase is the fact that we should have some stricter standards regarding these products that are being put onto the market. It's very important to know what chemicals we are adding into our land.
Are there some ways that people can be more environmentally conscious when handling these compostable products, or is this sort of a situation of needing to do a complete recall of these products?
Yeah, so obviously as a consumer, it is quite difficult to tell what products are compostable a lot because there is a lot of greenwashing that is happening. So I guess the main thing is looking for certification labels and trying to adhere to that as much as possible. And if you are just simply unsure, putting that in the rubbish bin is probably best case scenario, unfortunately.
The report advocates for a Te Ao Māori approach to maintaining soil health. What would this look like?
So it includes sort of incorporating Māori in the research process, so making sure their voices are advocated for, and incorporating sort of tikanga Māori principles and sort of everything we do in terms of our practices of composting.
And what sort of initiatives would you like to see the government take following the findings of these studies?
So it'd be good to have a closer look at what certifications we have implemented, because currently in New Zealand we don't really have regulations concerning compostable products. So it would be good to enforce this just to give consumers a clearer understanding of what to do with their products, because at the moment companies can sort of chuck any sort of labelling on products and that can get quite confusing.
That was PhD candidate in environmental sciences at the University of Auckland, Nargis Talib, about the findings of a study conducted by the university about compostable products and the need for better regulations around them.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koto katoa I kōrero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party Simon Court, Criminology Lecturer at the University of Auckland, Emi Rakete, National Chair of the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa, John Minto, Lecturer in Counselling, Human Services and Social Work at the University of Auckland, Kendra Cox, and PhD candidate in environmental sciences at the University of Auckland, Nargis Talib. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koto te e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.